Right. Not only the second talk about quadratic Fourier analysis, but also the second talk with a computer. And I've most people just said it went okay. And but I have one slightly more youthful reaction that has will slightly change the style of this presentation from yesterday. Not in the way that you'll notice unless I draw attention to it, but I will. So let's just start with a small recap. Looking around, I sort of recognize most of the faces here, but there may be one or two people from yesterday who are not familiar with these things. So let's just quickly remind ourselves of the definition of the U2 norm, which, at least in the most generalizable form, is given by the expression there. You sort of average over what you can think of as parallelograms or products of the function f and take an expectation. And then that generalizes to the U3 norm, and I thought if I put the formula for the U2 norm and the U3 norm, then once again you'd be able to work out what the UK norm must be. It's a lot more illuminating not to write the formula for the UK norm than to write it, I think, somehow. And the main feature that I was concentrating on yesterday about these norms was that expressions that are highly relevant to counting arithmetic progressions are robust when you make little changes to the FIs, where little is measured by the appropriate UK norm. And so for progressions of length k, it's the UK minus 1 norm. Plus, I should make a remark, which I forgot to make yesterday, about why the UK minus 1 norm governs progressions of length k, and is that not... because this problem's going to arise again with sort of everything you can do to within plus or minus 1. And it's just simply because these are three-dimensional objects that you're averaging over, and it's just an unfortunate fact of life that you need three-dimensional objects for progressions of length 4 and so on. And so it's impossible to avoid confusion somewhere, and this seems to be the best. How do you see that it's positive? That's actually quite simple. If you substitute y for x plus c, so you then get an expression of x, y, and a and b, then the thing for y is the complex conjugate of what you've got for x, and so it works out as a sum of modulus squared. It's quite a simple thing to check. Well, that's proof that it's non-negative, but getting that it's positive comes from that as well, more or less. And then yesterday I was talking about inverse theorems. There was a simple inverse theorem that said that if you've got a function with large U2 norm, then exploiting the fact that, I'm being a bit vague here, of course the function had certain assumptions about it, in particular that it should be bounded, but then because under that circumstance the U2 norm is roughly the same as the L infinity norm of the Fourier transform, you get correlation of your function f with some trigonometric function or linear phase function. And a much more complicated result, the theorem of Green and Tau, says that if you've got a function with a large U3 norm, then it correlates with something that's unfortunately not a quadratic phase function, but it's a slightly more general object that is very quadratic in nature. It's not vital to remember for this talk, even though I shall use this quite a lot, it's not actually that important to remember what the definition of a quadratic phase function is. If you just think of it as something that sort of mostly takes values of modulus sort of round about 1 and is fairly sort of a bit like an exponential in a quadratic, that will sort of do, I think, for following the talk. But there's a little bit more to Fourier analysis than just taking a function and showing that it correlates with a trigonometric function. In particular, a notable thing that one often does with Fourier analysis is actually just decompose a function into some or linear combination of trigonometric functions. And that we can do because it's easy to prove that the trigonometric functions form an orthonormal basis. And that doesn't seem to generalize terribly easily because the generalized quadratic phase functions don't form a basis, and there's a very simple reason for that, just as there are far too many of them. If we're talking about functions defined on Zn, even the ordinary quadratic phase functions, if you forget the constant term, you've still got n squared functions, and what's more, those functions are all almost orthogonal to each other, or some of them are actually orthogonal to each other. So you've got a big selection of functions, far too many to form a basis, and so you've got an overdetermined system. So you've definitely got a problem if you want to expand in terms of this set of functions. And that problem gets even worse when you look at generalized quadratic phase functions. So that looks like bad news, and in a way it is bad news, but it's not as bad as it might seem, because very often in arithmetic combinatorics, what you actually want to do with Fourier analysis is take a function and decompose it into a sum of a few trigonometric functions plus something else that you can regard as small in some sense. And this statement here, that you can decompose a function as a sum of a few trigonometric functions plus something that's small in U2, is something that follows quite easily from the, again, if the function is bounded, quite easily from basic Fourier analysis. And that's something that we can hope to generalize to the quadratic case, because we no longer care whether the set of functions that we're expanding into is a basis. So there's some hope of decomposing in that way. And what I want to talk about first is a very general method for deducing decomposition theorems from inverse theorems. I should say before I start that it's not the only way of doing it, and later on I will talk about a different method and say something about how the two methods compare with each other. So a little bit of abstract maths now. A reminder of some basic functional analysis. So if you've got a normed space, which for my purposes I'll just think of as R to the N with a norm on it, then there's a standard definition of a dual norm. You just define the dual norm of a function phi to be the largest inner product of phi with any function f that has norm at most 1. And the inner product is just the standard inner product with respect to the inner product with respect to the standard basis, except that I like to use expectations, and so I've put down here the normalization will be the expected value of fx times the complex conjugate of phi x rather than the sum of fx times the complex conjugate. But that doesn't make a huge difference, it's just convenient. I've put a trivial lemma there. Well, why is that trivial? Well, suppose f has norm 1, then by the definition of the dual norm, we know that the inner product of f with phi must be at most the dual norm of phi. So it's true when the norm of f is 1, and then it just scales up for other norms of f. So that's more or less true by definition, a trivial lemma. It's a definition plus scaling up and down. If I defined the dual norm in a different way, it would have been actually true by definition. And a familiar example is that the dual of LP is LQ. So if you define, and then if you define your LP norms using expectations, then this is the inner product you want in order to get the L2 norm, the dual to the LQ norm also defined with expectations. The next tool sort of is the Hahn-Banach theorem for finite dimensional normed spaces. So let's just warm up with, first of all, a definition and a rather simple... Well, the fact that is kind of looks very simple is slightly less simple than it looks, but nevertheless not too bad. So, first of all, a definition of a support functional. And I think it's easier to draw a picture, actually. So here's a... I used to be a little Banach space theorist and used to draw these pictures a lot. So for me, that's a normed space. Actually, I have some friends who are rather more extreme, and they say that when you've got a high-dimensional normed space, it looks like that. But because one's intuitions about volumes are sort of wrong, and so if you draw something convex, you get the wrong idea. But anyway, that's Vitaly Milman's picture of a high-dimensional normed space. But let's stick with ones that actually look convex. I haven't drawn it symmetric, because if you draw it symmetric, then it really, you don't have enough somehow freedom to draw anything. So in reality, of course, it is symmetric. What is this, of course? This is the unit ball of a norm. It's a set of vectors of norm at most 1, which forms a convex body, and it's a symmetric convex body. And how do you represent a linear functional? Well, linear functionals look like this. They're just sort of hyperplanes, and that's supposed to be the set of points where it takes value 1. and a support functional of a point of norm 1, that's like that, is a functional that, what is, by the way, the value of this functional, say, at this point? Well, you just take a parallel line that goes through the origin and see what proportion of the distance you are from here to here, and that's the value of the functional at this point. Okay, so a support functional at a point is a functional that takes the value, if it's on the boundary of the ball, that takes the value 1 at that point, and at no other point in unit ball does it take the value greater than 1. So it's got to be sort of like that, a tangent hyperplane to the unit ball. And you can sort of regard the one version of the finite-tree Hahn-Banach theorem as saying that any convex body has actually got tangent hyperplanes at its boundary, which sort of seems geometrically obvious, but it is something that needs to be proved, and you prove it by induction on the dimension. I think that's... I thought I had something else to say about that, but we have a theorem that every function has got a support functional, and this proof is not, as I say, not really a proof, but it almost looks like one. And we can generalize it ever so slightly. If we've got any convex body, so now let's have 0 over here or something. Say you've got a convex body that contains 0, and you've got a point that doesn't belong in the convex body, then you can separate the point from the convex body by a linear functional. So we can find some functional, or geometrically we can find a hyperplane such that the convex body is on one side and 0 is on one side and f is on the other side. And the analytic way of saying that is you can find a function phi such that the inner product of phi with f. So by the way, what would the function phi be? It would be a function that, so if this is the functional equals 1 hyperplane, then phi is going to sort of point off in this direction, and it's modulus will be such that that distance times that distance equals 1, something like that. So the nearer the functional is to, or the nearer this hyperplane is to 0, the bigger the functional. You've got to get that idea in mind, because it's 1 nearer to the origin. But anyway, more generally, if you've got a convex body that contains the origin, you can separate it from a point that's not in a convex body by a hyperplane, which is the same as saying you can find a function phi such that the inner product of phi with f is, I put greater than or equal to, actually if it's a closed convex body, we could even say greater than, I think I will be using that. The statement that the convex body is on this side of the hyperplane is just saying that every point G in K has inner product less than or equal to 1 with this function phi, which corresponds to the hyperplane. So this is the hyperplane, inner product with phi equals 1. And we can get a corollary from that, which is something quite useful. If you want to decompose something if you want to decompose a function as a sum of other functions, and the property that you want from those other functions is that they should belong to certain convex sets, then there's a rather nice thing you can do, which is to say, well, if it's not true, then apply the Hahn-Banach theorem and see what you get. So in this case, I've got an F that doesn't belong to the sum of these convex bodies, which I'm assuming all contain 0. Then what we can do is find some non-negative constants that add up to 1. That should say less than or equal to 1, but then you could just multiply them and get it to be equal to 1, but it's a little less natural to say equals 1. Such that the inner product of F with phi is greater than 1, whereas the inner product of phi with any GI from KI is at most lambda I. Now, just to see what make this corollary make sense, just notice that supposing you've got a functional with this property, you've got a functional, phi, such that the inner product with f is bigger than 1, and the inner product with gi is always at most lambda I, then it's trivial that f doesn't belong to the convex body k1 up to kr, because then f would have to equal a sum of some gi's, and just apply phi to the sum of those GIs, and you get something that's less than or equal to 1, and apply phi to f, and you get something greater than 1, contradiction. So this is a sort of trivially sufficient condition for F not to belong to the sum of the Ki's, and it turned out to be necessary. So one way of thinking about this is, if you've got something that's not in a sum of some convex bodies, then there must be a linear proof that it's not in the sum of those convex bodies. There must be some functional that just tells it to you trivially. Well, you can still do something, but it just, you can't guarantee that F is bigger and the GIs are smaller. It might be that the GIs had to be bigger and F is smaller, things like that. But you still, you get a statement. And you could just shift the origin if you wanted to, and, or shift the convex bodies. So it's easy to deduce more general things, but it's just technically easier to assume that zero belongs to these things. And it will do in all the applications I'm going to talk about. Let's just see how to prove it. Now, this is the point at which my practice has changed. I was advised that going like this doesn't appeal to people. So I've decided to recall what it is that we're trying to prove here. So these are the sort of the things we're aiming for, and in nice, convenient form at the top of the slide. So what are we trying to get? We've got a function that doesn't belong to some of the convex bodies, and we want a phi with those properties, and also we want the lambda-i's. I haven't actually said we want the lambda-i's, but that's true too. So step one, k1 up to kr is already a closed convex body. So f doesn't belong to it, so we can apply Hahn-Banach. I'm jumping ahead. Because it's closed, we can actually find a positive delta, so that 1 minus delta times f doesn't belong to the convex body. Now let's apply the finite tree Hahn-Banach, or the sort of separation thing. Let's separate f from k1 up to kr with a functional phi, which says that we can separate 1 minus delta f, so we can find phi where the inner product with 1 minus delta f is greater than or equal to 1, and the inner product with g is less than or equal to 1 whenever g belongs to this convex body k1 up to kr. Now let's choose the lambda i's, which I do in the most obvious way possible. I just choose lambda I to be the maximum value of the inner product of gi with phi for a gi belonging to ki. Perhaps I ought to assume that the ki's are bounded or something like that. I'm not sure whether I really need it, but again, they will be in applications. The lambda i's are obviously non-negative because I can choose gi to be 0. That's where I use that assumption. And they add up to at most 1, because if they added up to something bigger than 1, then I can just choose a GI that maximizes, and then I'd immediately have that the sum of those GIs with phi, the inner product, was greater than 1. So, which I've got is not the case. So, that's it. It just sort of follows more or less formally. So, actually, in practice, one can get away with a weaker thing. So why is this a simpler version? The lambda i's aren't there anymore. I've just set all the lambda i's to be 1. So whereas the previous thing was an equivalence, this is no longer an equivalence, but it's just convenient not to have to keep messing around with the lambda i's. Instead, we just say, if f doesn't belong to the convex body, then you can find a function phi such that inner product with f is greater than 1, and each gi has inner product at most 1. So sometimes that simpler form is good enough. So now let's see why that can be used to get a decomposition theorem out of an inverse theorem. So let's go back to the inverse theorem that I ended with yesterday. That if you take a bounded function that has U3 norm that's not too small, then you can find a generalized quadratic phase function. I didn't say anything about complexity, but if you remember, I mentioned generalized arithmetic progressions, and you don't want their dimensions to be too big and things like that, but this is an issue that let's not worry about too much. We can find some generalized quadratic phase function that correlates well with f. But the argument I'm going to talk about is very, very general, so it doesn't really matter. As I say, I'm not going to use any properties of what generalized quadratic phase functions are, or nothing that really... I probably will use at least something, but... nothing that really requires one to remember the definition at all precisely. Let me tell you what I shall deduce from the inverse theorem. And this is from a paper that I'm writing with Julia Wolf. Um, what we'll do is we'll get from the inverse theorem is if I've got a function with L2 norm at most 1, then you can decompose it as the sort of thing I was talking about at the beginning. A linear combination of generalized quadratic phase functions plus two things that I think of as error terms. Now, the G is small in the U3 norm, which means that if you are considering expressions like expected value over x of d of f1x, f2x plus df3x plus 2 df4x plus 3d, then we don't really mind if we make, if we move g, if we sort of forget g. And h will be small in the L1 norm. And that, has been, again, in the application, it turns out that that is sufficiently good to count as a small error. And the QIs are generalized quadratic phase functions, and the sum of the lambdas, or the absolute value, or the sum of the absolute values of the lambdas is not too large. Now, I said at the I said on the previous slide, which I will resist the temptation to go back to, the title was Inverse Theorems Imply Decomposition Theorems. I'm actually just going to show you that one inverse theorem implies a decomposition theorem, but I think it should be pretty obvious that the argument is extremely general, and you can just do it for pretty well any inverse theorem will imply some corresponding decomposition theorem. I have written down the most general, that's a dangerous thing to say, a pretty general thing that follows from this. So, again, I've just added this a few minutes ago, a sort of bit saying this is what we're trying to shoot for here. So that's how we want to decompose F. And we know, well, I'll remind you about the inverse theorem in due course. So the inverse theorem is a thing we're going to be able to use. So Hahn-Banach theorem says we suppose that we can't find a decomposition. If you can't find a decomposition, then you can find a function phi, and what is the what are the properties that phi is going to have? Well, actually, before I go into, let me just say what the three convex sets are. So the three convex sets are the set of all those linear combinations of generalized quadratic phase functions, such that the absolute values of the lambdas add up to at most one, most m. Then another convex body will be the epsilon times the unit ball of the U3 norm, and another convex body will be epsilon times the unit ball of the L1 norm. So just considering epsilon times the unit ball of the L3 norm, of the U3 norm, we get that if phi is small everywhere, or is at most 1, everywhere on epsilon times the unit ball of the U3 norm, then that is precisely saying that the U3 dual norm of phi is at most epsilon to the minus 1. Similarly, the fact that phi in a product with all functions of L1 norm at most epsilon is at most 1, that's precisely telling you that phi has L infinity norm at most epsilon to the minus 1. And the third thing is, I've just written it out in a little bit more without, I haven't actually explicitly mentioned the convex body, but we've got a convex set of things here, and their inner product with phi is at most 1. Now, if I set lambda I to equal m, and all the other lambda I's to be 0, that's got to fit most 1. So that tells us that phi can't have an inner product of more than m to the minus 1 with any generalized quadratic phase function q. And finally, we know that the inner product of f with phi is greater than 1. Now, we've got the fact that the U3 star norm of phi is at most epsilon to the minus 1. I claim that that implies that the U3 norm of phi is at least epsilon. Why is that? It's because, let's suppose that's not true, then the L2 norm of phi squared, I'm not going to write this down, we get that the L2 norm, I can't remember, of phi squared, which is the inner product of phi with itself, then by the trivial lemma, that's at most the U3 star norm times the U3 norm, which is at most 1. F, we're assuming, has L2 norm at most 1. Therefore, by Cauchy-Schwarz, the inner product of F with phi is at most 1, which is a contradiction. So what have we got? We've got that phi is bounded. It's got not too small a U3 norm, but it has very small correlation with all generalized quadratic phase functions. And that contradicts the inverse theorem. So it's sort of a more or less formal argument, gets you a decomposition theorem from an inverse theorem. Okay, now we'll come back to how that's used and all the application for it in a moment. This is just a reminder of things I was talking about yesterday. Let's call a set uniform of degree k if it approximates a constant function in the, and the constant function, by the way, as I've said, the constant function is, the constant is the density of the set A. So if it approximates its own density, so to speak, in the UK norm, we'll say that it's uniform of degree K. Do I mean that? No, in the UK plus one norm. So here's one of these K, K plus ones. So in particular, quadratically uniform means approximating in the U3 norm, and that's because, unfortunately, the three-dimensional objects correspond to the sort of quadratic phase functions. And so we just have a we have to live with that, and it means that I have to stop and think every single time which UK norm is going to control the progression to length what. It's very annoying, but there we are. So, believe me, I thought about it, it really is K minus 1, that means that if you've got a set that's uniform degree K minus 1, then it's got, this expectation is roughly delta to the K, which is what you'd get for a random set A. And the proof, which I showed you yesterday in a more general setting, would go, you'd approximate that A by delta 1 in UK, argue that you haven't changed the sum very much, approximate that one by delta, things don't change by very much, keep going, nothing has changed by very much, but when you've changed all the A's into constant functions, you do get equality there, and therefore you get a rough equality before you started. Okay, now the thing that Julia Wolf and I were thinking about was more general linear configurations than arithmetic progressions. So let's just take a typical example of the kind of thing that we might look at, or one might look at. Just an expression like that. So before we had x, x plus d, x plus 2d, and so on. Here, this is not an interesting example. I hesitate to inform my co-author, who's looking a little worried. This is just a sort of random bunch of linear forms to which we apply A. So this time I've got three variables. Before I just had X and D. Here I've got X, Y, and Z. I take some random linear combinations. Random in the sense that my children use the word random, meaning it's maybe a British thing. It perturbed me very much, actually, the probabilistic combinatorialist. To hear them use the word random just means sort of slightly pathetic or something. But some piece of slang that people under a certain age, I don't know what the threshold is. I don't know whether it includes my research students, for example. Anyway, one might expect from what one knows about arithmetic progressions that if A is suitably uniform, i.e. if A is uniform of degree K for some sufficiently large K, then we'd be able to say that an expectation like that is roughly what it would be if A were a random set of density delta, in which case, in this case, it would be delta to the 5, unless I'd accidentally... No, that would be okay. And indeed, one can do something along these lines. And Green and Tao have investigated, or are investigating, and have investigated and are continuing to investigate, finding linear configurations in the primes. They've so generalizing their results about arithmetic progressions in the primes in two directions. One is finding linear configurations, and another is finding asymptotics for how often they appear. And as part of that project, one of the easier parts of that project, was to think a bit about just to prove that for every configuration of that form there will be a UK norm that is sufficient to guarantee that it occurs with the correct frequency. And that led them to define something called complexity of a system of linear forms. Um, It's a little bit hard to digest when you first see this. But you take a bunch of linear forms. So the linear forms are things like this, x, x plus y, x minus 3, y plus z, etc. You say that it's got complexity at most k at I, if when you remove li from your collection of linear forms, you can then partition the other forms into at most k plus 1 sets. It turns out to be, again, that k plus 1 is a good choice rather than k. K plus 1 subsets, none of which span li. This is one of those definitions where much easier than the definition is to have an example or two. So let's consider arithmetic progressions. In fact, let's even just look at arithmetic progressions of length 4. And let me prove that this system has complexity 2. So my forms now are x, x plus d, x plus 2d, x plus 3d, and let's suppose I remove that form. How many sets do I need to partition these remaining things into if I don't want this to be in the linear span of any one of the sets in the partition? Well, as soon as I choose two of these things, I can get x and I can get d, and therefore I can get x plus 2d. So I've got to put them all into separate cells. So I have to choose at least three cells, or in fact I have to choose three cells, and three is k plus 1, and therefore the complexity is 2. Complexity 2 corresponds to needing quadratic uniformity, so the U3 norm. Complexity 2 corresponds to the U3 norm, but it's quadratic. And so the complexity, in general, the complexity for progressions of length k is k minus 2, which tells you that you need uniformity of degree k minus 2, which fits with progressions of length 4 need quadratic uniformity. So it really is an appropriate definition. Here's a second example that's rather nice. And there's a rather nice result of Balog, which says, if I remember it correctly, that if you, in the primes, you can find configurations of the form xi plus xj over 2. You can find x1 up to xk such that all of those things are primes. Now, I'm not sure that, when I say implicitly, as a strongish sense, I mean, I don't know. It's funny talking about other people's results when they're in the audience. But this system turns out to have complexity 1, which, given that Balog proved this result before quadratic uniformity and the Green Tau inverse theorem came into existence, was essential to the proof. So in that sense, he was sort of exploiting the fact that it had low complexity. So why does the system of forms xi plus xj have complexity 1? Because if you remove xi plus xj, then no other form involves both xi and xj. So you can have ones that don't involve xi over here and ones that don't involve xj over here, and therefore you don't span xi plus xj. So you've got two sets, therefore complexity 1. And Green and Tau proved this fact, which generalizes the what I've been talking about UK norms controlling progressions of length k plus or minus 1, whatever it turns out to be. So if you've got a system of complexity at most k at every I, and a set that's uniform of degree k, then the expression. So L1, this x is a boldface x, so you should think of it as standing for x1 up to xr or something like that. And so each li of x1 up to xr will be sort of ai1 x1 plus air xr. But you could just think of that as being an expression rather like the one that I wrote earlier on, but in a slightly condensed notation. Actually, that's not the most that you can squeeze out of what they did. That's a slightly stronger assumption than you need, that it's got complexity at most k at every single I think. Let me not bother to go into that. But let's just think about the opposite direction. So complexity k is controlled by the UK plus 1 norm, But do we really need the UK plus one norm? That's the question. That doesn't follow from what I've said so far. Well, let's just think about how we get interesting examples of functions and how they relate to UK norms. And if you remember, yesterday I was talking about arithmetic progressions of length 4, and I wanted an example of functions that were highly uniform, but for which the expressions like this were not robust when you made small, or when you approximated them by zero. And the way we did it was to take quadratic phase functions. And so in the particular example I had yesterday was e to the 2 pi I x squared over n, and so on. And if you plug those in, then you get en of x squared minus 3x plus d squared plus 3x plus 2d squared minus x plus 3d squared. And the thing inside the en is identically 0, so the en of it is identically 1. And so the whole expectation came out to be 1. And yet the quadratic phase functions were extremely uniform. So absolutely vital to that was that we had an identity of this form. And in particular, what we needed to make it work was that these squares of the linear forms that we were talking about, x squared, x plus d squared, x plus 2d squared, and x plus 3d squared, should be linearly dependent, so that we can choose the coefficients 1, minus 3, 3, and minus 1, so that everything cancels out and gives us an expectation of 1 up at the top there. So let's just think a little bit about what we can sort of get from there. Turns out not to be hard to prove that the polynomial phase function and more general ones than that have small UK norm but large UK plus one norm. In particular, we've seen that for quadratic ones. I proved it yesterday. Quadratic ones have small U2 norm but big U3 norm. If you've got some linear forms that have linearly dependent kth powers, then you can just sort of choose appropriate coefficients of x to the k and do something similar to what we did for progressions of length 4 and get examples that are not robust when you perturb. Or do UK plus one perturbations. So what that tells us is that it's difficult, it's not going to be possible to prove that you need UK plus one unless you've got some linear dependence amongst the kth powers of the relevant linear forms. Well, that doesn't show that, but it suggests that. And here's an example on which we can focus. The problem is sort of bubbling up, and here's an example we can focus our minds on. Here is something that has complexity 2, so the green tower result tells you that U3 norm will suffice, but if you can check that the squares of these linear forms are linearly independent, and so there's no sort of simple way of using quadratic phase functions applied to those linear forms in order to get a cancellation and get a large expectation. So the question arises, just for this particular system, do we need U3 norms or will U2 norms do? Well, that's what I've just been talking about. So is that. That summarizes what I said over the last 45 seconds or so. And the answer turns out to be that the sort of the square independence is actually telling us the right thing in this particular case. And more generally, if you've got a system of linear forms and it has complexity 2, and you take the corresponding expression, which I've now actually not used the boldface X, but I've actually expanded it out a bit more, then that is controlled by U2 perturbations rather than U3 perturbations, if, and only if, the squares of the linear forms are linearly independent. So if the squares of the linear forms are linearly independent, you can get more than you get from the sort of Cauchy-Schwarz type arguments that Green and Tao used for their analysis of complexity. Now, a very important remark to make, and experience suggests that from the one time I've talked about this before, that it is important to stress this quite strongly. And that is that the fact that you only need to worry about the U2 norm doesn't mean you can use linear Fourier analysis. It's a slightly peculiar situation. We have to use quadratic analysis, Fourier analysis in an essential way to prove this result, even though in the end what we're proving is that only the sort of linear Fourier norm controls what we're talking about. So let me give you an extremely sketchy. Well, that pause was just there for because I noticed that I'm racing through the slides again. So I thought a small delaying tactic. So let's have a very, very approximate idea of the proof. And then I did actually make in desperation last night, because actually we're already beyond what I initially thought would fill an hour. So I'm going to say rather more than I had intended, and I've got a sort of variable. At any stage I can stop from now on, but I think I will get through to the end. So a very rough idea of how we go about this. First, we apply the decomposition result that I just talked about. So we take each fi in the expression that we had. So the expression would be an expectation over all the variables of a product over fi applied to the li linear form of your m variables. But it's easier just to have in mind an example such as, let me just, rather than thinking in full generality, let's just imagine that we've got E x, y, z of f1x, f2y, f3z, f4, x plus y plus z, f5, x minus 2y plus z, f6, x plus y minus 2z. That's the example I had before. That's the type of the expression we're talking about. So each fi, we decompose, I've used I a bit too much there, but never mind. So we decompose using this decomposition thing. So we get it as a sum of generalized quadratics. I'm glossing over a technicality, actually. Oh, yes, I've written there, I hinted that the QIs are slightly more general than generalized quadratics, but that's not too important. We want the modulo of the coefficients not to add up to too much. And we want both those, we want G and H to be small in appropriate senses. So one is small in U3 and another is small in L1. And that we can get from the decomposition result. Now, some generalized quadratic phase functions are rather annoying because they're a bit too close to linear phase functions. Let me give an extreme example. Let's suppose it was defined on a generalized arithmetic progression, and the shape of the generalized arithmetic progression was something like this. One more. And let's suppose that this generalized quadratic phase function was constant on there, and constant on there. Then it wouldn't be a very, and then maybe it takes the values 1, 4, 9 or something like that. So there's a nice, it turns out that that's a perfectly decent generalized quadratic phase function, or when you take En of it, it'll be a decent generalized quadratic phase function. However, it lacks various properties that one really wants from a generalized quadratic phase function, such as that the U2 norm should be small. So this is a technicality that occurs all through this area. Green and Tao had to face it in a slightly different context. You want somehow to get rid of the, we think of this as having sort of low rank. examples like this, or examples where not necessarily constant but sort of linear and things like that. We want to get rid of the low rank ones and just stick with the high rank ones. So an important thing that we want to do is the decomposition theorem as it stands tells us, this F is one of the FIs. What I've written up there is a bit confusing actually, because maybe I'm assuming that each FI is uniform or something. Let's assume that all the FIs equal F, because that is really the situation that we're interested in. So if all the FIs equal F, we would like to prove that something like this is small, as long as F has a very small U2 norm. Alright, so we want to use the assumption that F has a very small U2 norm to get a bit more information about the decomposition. And the extra information we want is that we can do it with all the QIs having high rank, and we can think of that as basically meaning they all have small U2 norms. Now intuitively, that sort of, intuitively in the sort of pathetic sense of intuitively, as in I don't have a proof type of thing, that's sort of obvious, because why would we need low rank QIs that have big U2 norm in order to get something that's got a small U2 norm? I'll say the same remark in a different way in a moment. My computer is refusing to advance by a page now. Oh. It just did it very slowly. So I've gone back several pages. Am I going backwards all the time? No. Okay, here we go. So all the good work I did before is totally undone now. Something very bizarre is going on at 10.
It's only being random.
All right, let me have a little... Let's see if I just close it and open it again. Now let's go back to, sorry about all this. This is very, very rough, but the idea is the error terms are small enough so you can ignore them, and the QIs are explicit enough that you can actually just do the calculation somehow. And if they've got high rank, you do the calculation and everything turns out to be small. And crucial to everything turning out to be small is that you don't get unwanted cancellations with the QIs. And there you very much need them to have high rank. So the rough idea behind this proof is that we can't produce examples using quadratic methods, and yet quadratic methods, the sort of quadratic decomposition sort of shows that quadratic examples are the only ones that you could conceivably have. And so if those don't work because of the square independence, then nothing's going to work. Well, I said I would talk a little bit about other ways of producing decomposition results. So Green and Tao also needed to use the inverse theorem to decompose functions, and they use energy arguments that were referred to earlier today. And the rough idea of that is, again I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but you've got your group which I haven't said anything actually about FP to the N. Some of the results that Julia and I have are in the group FP to the N, where a lot of the technicalities are much simpler than they are for ZN. In particular, generalized quadratic phase functions really are exponentials of quadratic forms. So the rough idea is that you want to find a partition of the group into nice sets that are sort of defined in a quadratic kind of way, in such a way that F minus its expectation with respect to the partition, which I will just remind you the definition of, is small. So this is just an averaging projection onto the partition. So we've got a partition into quadratic type sets, we've got a function F, we replace it by its average on that cell in that cell, and we replace it by its average on that cell in that cell, and so on. And the cells themselves are defined in a nice quadratic way, and therefore what we've said is that F is decomposed into some things that are of quadratic type. And the rough way that they went about that was, oh dear. Is to use energy increments. I repeated myself from the previous slide and then got confused by having done that. So the rough idea here is, let's just suppose that we're not already done. So let's suppose that the U3 norm of F minus its averaging projection is not small. Now, one of the big advantages they have is that averaging projections preserve boundedness. And so since everything inside is bounded, we just can apply the inverse theorem in a very straightforward way to the fact to F minus this expectation and get that it correlates with some generalized quadratic. And you then pass to a refinement of the partition on which the generalized quadratic is roughly constant, and then a reasonably simple argument will enable you to show that on this refined partition, the L2 norm of the averaging projection has gone up a little bit. And you can't go on doing that forever, and therefore you end up eventually with a decomposition of the kind that you would like. And let me just say a little bit about how the two methods compare with each other, because they've got different features. So I've just said that the energy increment argument is rather convenient in one way, which is that everything always remains bounded as you go along. And that's not the case with the Hahn-Banach theorem. So I've got this sum sigma lambda I qi, for example. All I know is that the absolute values of the lambda i's add up to at most m. So I know that the value of this, its L2 norm, is at most m. And one of the sort of technical things that Julia and I did was this business of slightly generalizing the notion of a generalized quadratic average. A generalized quadratic phase function was in order to make the sum of these lambda i's not too big, so we've got at least some boundedness. But that's a technical point. But Green and Tao didn't have to worry about such technical points. With the energy increment argument of getting a partition, it's, again, you often have problems if things have low rank and you want to deal with those problems, and that's an important sense in which I, what I said before was okay, but it's often not strong enough for applications, and it wasn't strong enough for our application, that somehow you need to get rid of the low rank problems. And it seems that in both methods we need to get rid of low rank problems, but I can't absolutely guarantee that it can't be done with the Green-Tao approach in a cheap way, but we just seem to find that when we tried to do it, we got extremely bad bounds, whereas with the decomposition method, we got much better bounds. And I can give you some vague idea of why that was. But just one other point. The initial assumption I started with was that the L2 norm of F was at most 1, and not that the L infinity norm of F was at most 1. And that's a sort of a strange aspect of it. So we really don't need boundedness even to start with. we do have the problem that we get an L1 error term, which is one of the weakest sort of LP, well, it's the weakest LP type error term that you can get, but it turned out that was okay. But we didn't really exploit the fact that we had this extra flexibility to start with, but it's just a sort of amusing feature of the method. But another thing that I would say is that just the Hahn-Banach method is, in a way, it's simpler and more direct. You just say, well, if you haven't got a decomposition of the kind you want, here's a linear functional contradiction. You're not somehow constructing the decomposition. You're just saying if it's not there, then there's a contradiction. Perhaps some people wouldn't like to call that direct, but I find it direct in a sort of psychological sense, even if it's an indirect existence proof in another sense. Now let me just talk a little bit about this fact that we wanted to get the QIs to have high rank under the assumption that F had a small U2 norm. And here's the approximate method for doing that. So let me just do more justice to the remark that it really oughtn't to be necessary to have low rank forms involved. If you've got a low rank form, you can show that its U2 star norm is small. So if you're assuming that F has a small U2 norm, then by the trivial lemma at the beginning, F just doesn't correlate at all with Q. Now if you're trying to decompose a function into some other functions, it seems a bit odd that you might be forced to use functions that don't correlate with the function that you're trying to get. Why would you need to use functions that are more or less orthogonal to the function that you start with? So you might think there'd be some really simple argument that says, well, of course, you don't need to use those. You just use ones that have at least some correlation. And we've thought hard enough about it that sort of more or less convinced ourselves that there isn't some two-line observation or even half-line observation that says you couldn't possibly ever need functions that don't correlate. Somehow you can't sort of rule out that if this is your F, you might have to go like that to build up F. And so it's very annoying, but that seems to be the hardest part of the argument. So what we do is a fairly standard technique in many proofs in arithmetic combinatorics, that you find a sort of gap in which nothing too bad happens. So in this case, we sort of partition the QIs according to their ranks, making sure that all the intervals, I haven't told you what the rank is, but let's not worry about that. There is some definition that does the job that we want. We partition and we make sure that these numbers, the endpoints of the intervals, grow fairly rapidly. And if we've got enough cells of the partition, then we can't have too much weight in terms of the sums of the absolute values of the lambda i's belonging to every single interval. So there must be an interval somewhere that doesn't have too much weight in it. So let's suppose it's that one. Then if the sum of the lambda i's corresponding to qi's with ranks in this interval is small, then the L1 norm of the corresponding function, because the qi's have an infinity norm at most 1, and therefore L1 norm at most 1, is small. So you can just absorb this portion of the sigma lambda I qi into the error term. And once you've done that, you can think of F as being decomposed into a low rank part of this quadratic decomposition and a high rank part of the quadratic decomposition plus G and H. So that's what I've written here. And the low rank part, you can show that its U2 star norm is not too large. And then a method familiar to many people here, Bogoliubov's method, allows you to convolve something with a smallish U2 star norm in a way that will not change the function by too much in L2. So what we do is we take this equation up here and convolve both sides with a carefully chosen function beta, and convolving something in that's got a small U2 norm tends to produce something small. So convolving with beta has the effect of more or less killing off F, because F has small U2 norm, not really changing FL at all, more or less killing off FH, because FH has a small U2 norm, because it's got high rank, and at worst, and not increasing the U3 norm of G and not increasing the L1 norm of H. All those things are easy to prove. So what you end up showing is that approximately zero equals FL, or approximately FL plus approximately zero plus something that's not too big in U3 plus something that's not too big in L1, which means that we've shown that FL can be written as something that's not too big in U3 plus not too big in L1. So that means that you can absorb FL into the error term as well, and that way we say that the low rank contribution can be more or less ignored. It can be brought into the error term. And that way we get the decomposition we want into high rank bits. I'm out of time, so I think actually I will just forget the last bit I was going to say, because it's not relevant so much to the result that I'm talking about. So I'll stop there, and tomorrow I'm going to talk about further applications of this general method of decomposing functions into other functions. All right.